Hello, and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
And today we have
Gregory Kick from the Java Core Libraries team at Google, most notably recently, the tech lead for Dagger 2.
Okay, so core libraries, that's a plural. So I'm guessing there's more than Dagger 2, unless you just meant like plural is two.
No, right? both of the daggers. No, we do everything from Guava to a couple different annotation processor code generators, like AutoValue has recently been gaining a lot of popularity. And Dagger 2, those are probably our biggest focuses right now.
Okay, so
let's start with Dagger.
Yeah.
What's that?
All right. So, I mean, the story with Dagger goes, it was originally not a Google project. It was originally something started by Jesse Wilson and Jake Wharton over at Square. And the problem statement was quite simply that we know and love dependency injection. It's a great tool for building big and, you know, scalable and sort of manageable applications. But it flat out did not work on Android. Reflection has some costs that were, you know, not sustainable as into larger applications. So those guys did sort of a reinvention of dependency injection with a more code-generated solution, less reflection, more generated code. That actually was, we were very inspired by the work that we were doing, and we brought Dagger 1 into Google. And as part of a big effort, not on Android, but on the server side, we built that into large portions of the search stack, and we're very, very happy. But then we saw some opportunities for where we could get sort of take that to the next step and to use code generation more fully to completely eliminate reflection from the application and generate all of your dependency injection code from the top to the bottom completely statically. And that was Dagger 2.
So I'm curious, you brought it in and we're using it for things that were not Android. Like the Jesse Wilson, Jake Wharton thing was specifically for Android, right? But you
yes.
were just using it as a generic, powerful library because it had advantages on its own?
Right. There are some ancillary benefits that are, you know, actually kind of more what we focused on, you know, more strongly these days, is that when you generate things at compile time, you get to do a lot of analysis and a lot of error checking at compile time that used to have to be deferred to runtime. People that run large juice applications are very familiar with starting their application, waiting 30 seconds for everything to spin up, and then getting five stack traces with some pretty opaque errors and tracing that back to their code to try and figure out what happened.
And that's because Juice, which was an injection dependency injection library, is using reflection, I guess.
Yes, entirely reflection-based. Entirely at runtime, you have to start up your application for it to tell you anything.
Okay.
Dagger, because large portions of it were at compile time, it actually got to use the Java tooling APIs that allow you to put error messages at compile time directly, like put that little carrot from Java C directly on the elements that are giving you problems and give you a lot of really good, sort of more robust, quicker turnaround error messages and really improve developer experience in a way that we hadn't been able to even approach with Juice. So because, you know, search, as we all know, is a really, really large application, the idea that thousands of developers that contribute to that application, that we could improve their developer velocity even a little bit was very appealing. And aside from there are some performance reasons that it was appealing at the time. So, but most importantly, just the fact that we wanted to get a tool that at a really large scale was a little less frustrating than Juice can be into the hands of developers.
So that was Dagger 1, and it still had some reflection.
Yep.
And then you did Dagger 2. Are you using that in the search stack now?
Yes. Now that is actually all of Dagger 1 has been taken out completely and entirely replaced by Dagger 2. And it was, I think we've talked about this previously once upon a time, is that when we launched Dagger 2, we actually reined back something like in the 15 to 20% range of search CPU across the board.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a fair bit.
Wow.
And it was nice to have that. It was nice to sort of, you know, put in a lot of work towards a really big effort, flip a switch, and then actually see it sort of pay off in the way that we'd hoped.
And the initial motivation for all this was Android. So is Dagger 2 used in Google Android apps?
Absolutely. So now when it comes to, you know, Android applications in Google, 100% across the board with no caveats, the recommendation for dependency injection is Dagger 2. And you'll see that in, you know, kind of the nice thing, well, the good and the bad thing about Android applications is that people tear them down constantly and the dagger classes aren't exactly well hidden. So you can even go to some of these websites and they will report all of the places that Dagger 2 is present. And we, you know, it's all over the place. Everything from, I'm trying to think, maps to obviously the client-side search app and, you know, et cetera.
So if I'm an Android developer and I've never used dependency injection,
You're talking about me.
Yeah, if I'm Chet, what is this going to, like, what, how do I change my app and what will it give me?
So that's an interesting question. A lot of people are actually just trying to figure out sort of, you know, I'm developing my new app, how to get it sort of up and running. How to change your app is a pretty nuanced question because dependency injection has a tendency to be a little infectious.
Okay.
That you use it one place and then that spreads and spreads and spreads and, you know, sort of it becomes a very daunting effort very quickly.
All right. Let's say it's a brand new app.
Right.
And, okay, how do I change my workflow if I want to use Dagger 2?
Sure. And, I mean, this is, I will admit to everyone listening right now, is that up until just recently or sort of slightly in the future, this has been a very, you were pioneering some ground. We gave you a tool. How best to use it was sort of left up to you. But, you know, we've been working actually for the past couple quarters on specifically giving you really good answers to those questions, and some patterns have emerged. And essentially what we are trying to do is create a system by which Android is going to, because we can't do anything about it, it's going to initialize, or it's going to instantiate rather your application. It's going to instantiate your activities. It's going to instantiate your fragments.
From the manifest.
Right.
Right.
So that's going to happen no matter what. And that's sort of that seam that, you know, on a traditional server-side application, you know, your main method would be invoked by the operating system. Android punches a lot more holes. So we have to sort of account for all of those cases. And then what we're trying to do is establish really good patterns for saying, okay, the operating system has created your activity. And now you use that activity, you associate it, you know, a Dagger component is sort of the top-level construct like the injector was in Juice. You associate your Dagger component with your activity. And then from that seam down, Dagger does all the instance management for you.
And that will be for other kinds of instances than the Android activity. So if I have some model class, that is one I would fetch through Dagger.
Right. And the reason, you know, to go through all that effort is because what Dagger is trying to do for you is trying to instantiate only the instances you need, only when you need them. If you need one per activity, it's going to hold those references for you so that when your activity, you know, gets garbage collected, everything that was otherwise retained gets garbage collected, and so on and so forth. So the patterns that, and actually there's going to be an accompanying library very soon. I think portions of it are actually already checked into head, but not quite in a release yet. We are going to give you sort of the patterns and utilities to do that effectively so that, you know, at the application, at the activity, at the fragment level, at each of those levels, you have a good, clean, consistent way to tell Dagger to do that instance management for you. And then it sort of takes it from there. So we get rid of those, you know, sort of, you know, bugs that you get from leaks and, you know, overzealous applications initializing too much and burning through CPU that you didn't need to, and then not freeing memory as quickly as you could have otherwise. All of those will hopefully, you know.
So generally, to go back to me again, I'm writing this new app. Mm-hmm. Whenever I'm instantiating some other class and stashing in the field, this one I should be asking myself, hey, should I just have this being managed by Dagger instead? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the hope. I mean, basically, the general pattern can be described, and it's probably easiest for an application, is you've got your application on create. Your application will list all the things that it's going to depend on. It says, you know, inject foo, inject bar, inject whatever it is. And then in your application on create, you say, give me the instance of the Dagger thing that knows how to create foo and bar and all of its dependencies, and then assign them. And by doing that one operation, it will figure out all the transitive dependencies, when you need one instance versus many instances, et cetera, et cetera. And you just say, tell it to do it the one time, tell it to go. And then from that point down, it should all just be your model classes, all should be, you know, the application classes that you write as developer. And you can just associate them by sprinkling the, you know, standard annotations that we all know and love. Well,
okay.
Except Chet.
So that's how it works. I put annotations on my classes.
Yeah, that's the exact same, you know, standard JSR 330 annotations that have been, I think, part of Java EE 6 and beyond, but, you know, have driven Juice, have driven Spring, have driven, you know, dependency injection frameworks for a long time now, plus some configuration annotations and classes that look very similar to what people that are experienced with Juice would be familiar with.
And I assume there's also some API somewhere for me to access this, or does that get generated at build time? Like, how would I look some object up? Which API do I call for that?
Sure. So this is actually a philosophy that we've, you know, as part of the Java Core Libraries team, Kevin Brilliant did some really good sort of thought and research into this and wrote out sort of a design philosophy for generated code. The idea boils down to more or less that if you want a code generator to do some work for you, the way that that will be sort of most conceptually straightforward is you define an abstract type, some abstract methods, some, you know, pretty abstract structure that's just normal Java. In Dagger's case, we generally say an interface. Your interface says, all right, have a method that returns a foo, takes no arguments. Have a method that returns a bar, takes no arguments. And then you apply the Dagger annotation, which is at component. And Dagger's job is to generate the only implementation that makes sense. And so when you look at the code from sort of the calling side, you just see the interface that you wrote and you interact with the interface that you wrote. And then somewhere Dagger generates the one and only implementation that would reasonably make sense for that interface. And so that's the tie between the API that you created and the code generator. Is just if you name your component, you know, Chet's component, the implementation is called Dagger Chet's component, and you would, you know, create it through a builder just like you always would.
Which builder? The Dagger component one, the implementation class?
Yeah, so we either, if your class is sort of boring and not that interesting, we generate a builder for you. So, I mean, it's something okay. Akin to .builder.build.
I see.
Or actually, we have a convenience create method. But for the more interesting, more complicated cases, just like we say you create your interface and we generate the only reasonable implementation, you also create the interface for your builder and we generate the only reasonable implementation.
Cool. You ready to do this, Chet?
Absolutely. This answers every question I've ever had about dependency injection frameworks.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so, sort of, there's a, you know, for the listeners can't quite see the sideways glances, but the sales pitch that we try to give people sort of with Android moving forward is, in addition to giving kind of the, you know, testability and all of the typical promises.
Actually, can you talk more about that? Because I think that what we talked about so far was, you know, instantiating fewer objects and ensuring there were no leaks. And mm-hmm. those are really good goals. But how does this help with testability?
So at least throughout Google, we have found that people really like to rely on, and even go so far as to call, like, you know, a small test, still something that uses RoboElectric or uses Espresso or uses sort of one of the, you know, bits of testing infrastructure that relies on, you know, Android types and, you know, that whole Android ecosystem. What we are hoping is that by making it easier to disassociate your logic from the Android, you know, types like activity and whatever else, that you would actually be able to start testing larger and larger bits of your application by just instantiating, you know, the core logic of your application. And rather than saying, okay, well, I need to spin up a whole bunch of things to, you know, circuitously get, you know, X, Y, and Z from Android, maybe a location service. You can just mock out the location service, pass that to your dependency injected type, and rather than, you know, bringing up a whole sort of, you know, faked out Android environment, you just get to use sort of like more targeted fakes that are sort of easier to manage and then obviously much, much quicker to run.
I see. So instead of my code directly referencing location manager, I would just ask for a mock of one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you would do is you'd say, you know, here's my code here that does, you know, whatever it is with location. And you would say, okay, well, inject the, you know, inject the location manager with the at inject constructor. So, you know, at inject my type takes a location manager. And then as long as you can mock out that location manager and just that location manager, you can make a plain vanilla JUnit test that tests the logic of that application without all of the rest of the Android ecosystem. And, you know, at least, you know, from the way that Google has written tests traditionally, those are much, much quicker to run and can give you sort of signals for obvious errors very quickly.
Right. Is there a downside to this? The only one I'm thinking of is if we're adding all these extra methods and builders and so forth, I know Android has the 64K method limit, right? Are we talking about a very small number of additional methods per class, or so this is not a factor, or have you measured, you know, sort of the method count overhead you add when you do this?
So Yes and no. Much of the very first version of Dagger 2 was naive but consistent. It created a lot of extra wrapper objects where we, you know, if we did or did not need them, and a lot of extra methods, and cobbled it all together. It's not too terrible. It's not, you know, ideal. It's hard to really sort of point a, you know, finger at, like, this is the hard line where this is okay and not. Some people might not have chosen Dagger, you know, for that reason.
Well, I'm thinking especially the case you mentioned where, like, every class is, if you were to mock every single method call you were to do ever,
sure,
right? That would be super testable, but also that probably would be an unacceptable method count, I would think.
Right. So we've done a lot of work recently and continue to eliminating the overhead to get it sort of more like the ideal that we are always striving for is that the code we generate looks exactly like the code you would have written by hand. In the very optimal case, if you have a foo that takes a bar that takes a baz, we will actually say new foo of new bar of new baz. It can't really get any better than that. Yeah. And every time that you request some instance management or some of the more sophisticated features, there's obviously a little more bulk to it.
But that's presumably not down to like every single class has five of those.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then there's also sort of the other end to it, which is for a very long time now we've had as part of the Dagger documentation that we do expect that if you're going to talk to us about method count, if you're going to talk to us about performance, we are always going to consider post-ProGuard applications. It's very nice to write perfectly efficient generated code, but if this is a problem that is already solved by ProGuard, we are not going to bend over backwards to optimize the generated code in a way that ProGuard will anyway, because at least, you know, as far as, you know, Google is concerned, we assume that you are going to, you know, run ProGuard all over all of your applications, and that's just kind of the guarantee that we make.
Okay.
And sort of to the other end is we actually do spend a fair bit of time discussing, designing for, and then testing that the code that we generate is compatible with the ProGuard optimizations that we think are going to land.
So stepping back, before we got into the testability thing, you were halfway through a sales pitch.
Oh, sure. The sales pitch is basically that we will finally get to a place where Android developers don't sit down to an application and feel like they need to go back to referencing the activity lifecycle and the fragment lifecycle and all of these things in order to get an understanding about when and where and how to create and then drop references to their instances. We are trying to provide a sort of baseline layer for instance management and even all the way down to making sure that we have a good infrastructure for supporting on-prem memory to respond to memory pressure as your application is running. We want to provide a generated solution that is, you know, sort of easy to write code for, easy to understand once you look at the generated implementation, because we actually do expect people to go look at the generated code and be able to understand what it's doing and debug it. Finally just get rid of that concern of sitting down to writing an Android application is no longer an exercise in understanding life cycles. That's the sales pitch. I think it's appealing. I don't know, you know, sort of how quickly or to what extent we will be able to deliver on that, but that's our goal at least.
Interesting.
It's probably an easier pitch to someone who's coming from a server background and it's like, where's my injection library? And tougher for someone who's never done it. Who's like, well, what does this get me?
The feedback that we continually get is especially on these applications with larger teams, like, you know, Maps, for instance, is a huge application, is that there is a certain amount of knowledge share that, yes, there's a cabal of people on the team that know these concerns very well, and the application lifecycle is very well understood, and they know what they can and cannot do, but they are constantly fighting against new people coming on to the project that are making very understandable mistakes from a, you know, naive Android developer's perspective. And even from application to application, how they've solved these problems can be drastically different. And to a certain degree, and one of the things that we're tackling most immediately is from Dagger 2 application to Dagger 2 application, how they solve these problems can be different. So we're trying to kind of get an infrastructure that's, you know, got a lot of input, a lot of different concerns are, you know, considered, and then find the best compromise so that people have a pretty reasonable baseline to move forward with, And then, you know, we fully allow people to tweak it where we're not, you know, strict about that by any means. But the advice that we give is hopefully going to be a really good starting point for most people. And like I said, our goal is always to do that with as minimal overhead as possible.
And are you still working on it? Is Dagger 3 around the corner, or Dagger 2B or 2.1, or how does this work?
Right. So this is definitely not Dagger 3. We have no plans for that anytime soon. But what it really is an Android-specific set of libraries and patterns and documentation for how to apply Dagger 2 to Android. Because like I said, the tricky bit is all making sure that you associate, you know, your objects with the application in the right spot at the right time. The same with, I mean, activities and fragments. I mean, it's even, there are lifecycle callbacks for activities, but not for fragments. You know, some things you have to do in onCreate, some things you can do with callback, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Figuring all that out and giving people good salient advice and then a set of libraries that they can use to apply that advice consistently is what we're hoping to get. I mean, like I said, it's almost on the cusp of being, you know, part of our very next release. I mean, it should be within weeks.
Okay, so that is a work in progress, the making it easier for Android developers, including some of the lifecycle stuff that you were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, pieces of it are in head, but it is not yet part of a, you know, true release yet.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about head, actually, because a lot of the stuff, or all of the stuff, is developed in open source.
We have a workflow that we borrowed largely from Guava, which is that we develop all of our stuff internally in Google Source Repository,
yep.
But we mirror it out as quickly as possible. And that actually used to not be the case. We used to lag behind pretty badly. But now we are, I mean, no more than a day or two behind in GitHub than
So it's a complete mirror. You're not coming to a stable release and then pushing that. So Android, I think of Android as sort of being eventual open source where we work completely internally. And then when we have a stable release, we push that. You're actually much more active. Like, you're just mirroring on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and I mean, on a couple occasions, there's, you know, the semi-famous Android study group Slack channel. We lurk there in the Dagger channel. And if there is ever is a case where we're sort of curious or concerned or, you know, just need some feedback on what this looks like for our open source users versus our Google users, we will ask people to, you know, check something out from head, build it, give it a try in their application, let us know how it goes. I think there was actually an optimization or two that we knew sort of had success in Google with our, you know, Google applications and our Google toolchain. But, you know, as we all know, the open source set of libraries can be, you know, pretty different. The tools that, you know, they reach for is a little you know, certainly a little different than what we use internally sometimes. And so, you know, just send a message out to the Slack channel saying, can you guys build this from head? Let us know how it goes. We've had some pretty good success with that.
So you're mirroring source on a continual basis. How does that actually relate to the releases that you push?
Our releases are, I think we might have been lagging behind in the schedule lately, but they are essentially supposed to be clockwork releases. Google builds everything from head, so we assume that everything checked in at head at any given point in time is release quality. And then we essentially every 2 weeks aim to cut a new release of whatever happens to be there. And we've got a versioning scheme that reflects exactly how much we expected has changed. You know, minor releases like no new APIs, but yeah. Minor releases have new APIs, but point releases do not. So it's always Dagger 2 dot something, and I think we're up to 8 or 9 now.
Okay. So when you said some of the stuff is already in head, that means theoretically that stuff will actually be baked into an upcoming dot release in the next couple of weeks.
Yes. Yep.
All right. Cool. That was Dagger.
You said you're up to 2.8 or 2.9. What happens when you get to the one after .9?
Oh, .10.
2.10.
They're not decimal numbers.
Okay, no. So you're gonna stick with the two prefix forever.
Right. We are not a fraction of a three. Yeah, there is to a certain degree, and, you know, we've often lamented about whether or not, you know, it would have been a good idea to change the name between Dagger 1 and Dagger 2 because it was a little confusing. They were really different implementation strategies of the same API, and for a while there was, you know, nobody was really sure whether or not 2 was really meant to supplant 1 as far instead of just being different.
And have you talked to the original Dagger team, how they feel about you reusing their name?
Sure. They were, we talk with Jesse and Jake pretty often. They're, you know, former, at least Jesse is a former Googler. We've known them forever. And, you know, essentially, and they've even put it now on the Dagger 1 documentation, is, and not to put words in his mouth, but I believe this, his sentiment was that Dagger 1 is no longer being actively maintained. Dagger 2 is, and something that's being maintained is always better than something that's not. So now if you go to the Dagger 1 docs, it does say choose Dagger 2, but I also don't believe that they have any, you know, plans to tell people not to use Dagger 1. If your application is using Dagger 1, it will likely continue to use, you know, continue to work indefinitely. But obviously, we are strong supporters of migrating to Dagger 2.
Right. How does it work? Is it using an annotation processor? And what's the IDE support like?
Yes, it is absolutely using an annotation processor. It's unlike some of the annotation processors that kind of float around there, we are very strict about only using the standard APIs. We only do what an annotation processor is supposed to be able to do, which can be limiting. We can't look at the implementation of your, you know, methods or the implementation of your constructors and make, you know, certain optimizations that we might otherwise, you know.
And, that's so that your annotation processor will work across different compilers? Or,
yes.
Or,
okay. Well, that's the thought.
Have you considered just having different implementations for each compiler? There aren't that many.
There aren't that many. It's really, you know, when it comes down to it, it's basically Java C and Eclipse.
Yeah.
The reason that we are becoming more and more concerned about Eclipse these days is that Jack is underpinned by ECJ. So the problem with that is that we are, you know, very strict and diligent about coding to the standard APIs, but ECJ has long been full of bugs when it came to annotation processors. For better or worse, and reasons that I don't particularly understand, annotation processing first came out in 5, but then actually part of Java C and, you know, Java 6. It's been around forever, but hadn't really ever gotten a whole lot of traction. I mean, for a while, there were even some annotation processors doing some screwy things and poking into the compiler internals like Lombok and, you know, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a couple and discovered very quickly that I don't have access to what I need.
Right.
Right. So, for example, for the typedef extraction stuff, we couldn't use an annotation processor because you don't get access to the actual AST. So it's not possible to do it.
Sure.
So we actually run ECJ as part of the Gradle plugin to do it. It would have been nice if, you know, more use cases were accounted for in the standard API so that, you know, you could do this.
Sure. So, you know, our philosophy was we wanted to make this portable. We wanted to make it standard. We wanted to not break from compiler version to compiler version.
And I guess you don't have any really strong use cases for it.
Well, and here's the other end of it is that when before Android Studio was part of IntelliJ, you know, it was part of Eclipse, and you know, you wanted your annotation processors to run under Eclipse. But the biggest blocker is really that historically the implementation has been full of bugs. They do things that are not correct. Eamon McManus, who's the maintainer of AutoValue, does a fantastic job of documenting a lot of these things. And, you know, because AutoValue is a pretty targeted set of features, he provides sort of compiler independent workarounds for many of the quirks in Eclipse.
Hey, let's talk about AutoValue. Yeah. What's that?
So AutoValue is a hopefully reasonable way, you know, depending, you know, everybody always sort of has their where they want to draw the line with how much code is or is not generated. But it is a good way to generate value types. And it does so in sort of the same philosophy that I mentioned with Dagger, is you define an abstract type that says, all right, I am a value type. I have a foo, I have a bar, I have a string, I have an int, and it generates an implementation of toString and equals and hash code.
So value type is just like a simple class that just has some data in it? Like
yes.
A person or an address or whatever would have like first name, last name, and that's it. It's
exactly.
just data.
But without the bug between hash codes and equals.
Right.
That sounds like the real sort of sales pitch there.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a...
Why is there no bug between them?
Well, because theoretically, the code that generates those algorithmically could be maybe more consistent in how it does that, as opposed to depending on people to doing the right thing.
So those are generated then,
the
equals and hash code. Any other like value type convenience methods added?
ToString
maybe?
Yeah, so toString is certainly in there. And then support for builders. And it actually has a plugin API. So people have added support for memoizing methods and for, I think, lazy initialization is in there. Just kind of, you know, general sort of value type management things. But the nice thing is that the implementations of things like equals and hash code are I mean, you look at them and they look tedious. They are difficult and annoying to write because we've had runtime utilities for things like that, you know, objects.hashcode that took a, you know, var args of objects and, you know, did all the hashcode munging. But because they're generated and because a human doesn't have to maintain that code, you don't pay the cost of the extra, you know, object array allocation in order to call objects.hashcode. So they are very efficient. The only sort of cost of auto value is, I guess, the cost at compile time, but then the fact that you have two objects instead of one. But on an Android application, if ProGuard is doing its work, those get merged right back into one class again.
Okay. Two objects?
Because you have the abstract type. Two classes, rather.
Oh, classes. Got it.
Yeah, okay. The abstract type that defines sort of what you want in the implementation. But ProGuard should be able to flatten those right back down to one again.
Right. Okay. And I'm assuming the same set of apps are using this as well?
I mean, auto value is prevalent virtually everywhere in Google. You know, on the server, on Android, it's gotten remarkable uptake very quickly. And I think that speaks largely to the fact that Eamon and Kevin Brillion spent a lot of time carefully considering the trade-offs. Where do you draw the line? How much magic do you put in the code generator that's inferred but then difficult to understand? You know, how they, you know, they weighed brevity and utility and all of these various factors and performance, obviously, in order to strike a really good balance that I think enough people have found appealing that they've really started using it pretty widely.
So that was internally. What about externally? And is this part of the same open source repository that we were talking about for Dagger 2, or are these separate things?
This is different. Dagger 2 is at GitHub/Google/Dagger. This is GitHub/Google/auto is where auto value and auto factory and auto, a whole bunch of other auto things, but auto value being the most popular. I pay some amount of attention to uptake of Dagger and occasionally Guava these days, but I've never actually looked into sort of external adoption. You can usually fudge some numbers out of Maven Central to figure out who's depending on it, but we haven't looked that closely.
Mainly making sure that people can actually get to it externally.
Oh, yes.
It wasn't just like an internal thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, they probably wouldn't even go to the Git repository. I'm guessing there's like a Gradle plugin you apply.
No, this is all annotation processors in the exact same way.
Okay. So if I'm an Android developer and I want to use this, at the end of the day, I still have to mess with my build.gradle file. I guess there's some sort of Gradle plugin then that supports annotation processing that I apply to my project. And then I'm trying to figure out how, because I'm sure I don't have to go and actually git clone Google/auto.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
I'm assuming there's just some simple pre-built thing I use.
Right. So it's an artifact in Maven Central. All of these things are, you know, thrown into Maven Central somewhere. But then old versions of Gradle, you actually had to get an annotation processor plugin to augment the invocation at Java C to add the app. But I believe newer versions of Gradle now support it natively.
Okay. Cool.
All right. So then the third one that we mentioned earlier was Guava.
Guava.
So what's going on with Guava?
So for a very long time, and this has been reflected sort of in the work that we do, I think people can probably figure this out. For a very long time, Google has been working towards getting Google on Java 8. So there was, you know, a lot of time spent, you know, upgrading to a very significantly different version of the platform. And now that work is finally done. We have just recently released our very first version of Guava that supports Java 8 and Lambdas and all of those wonderful things.
And real quick, Guava is?
Guava is a set of, you know, sort of common utilities and libraries and collections, and, you know, that what we hope to be is sort of that first level of utility above what the JDK or above what Android provides. You know, things like immutable lists and immutable sets, things like Base64 encoding, things like checking preconditions, those types of things.
Multimap.
Oh, multimap, yeah.
It's my favorite.
So, yeah, sort of large collection of things like collections. I think traditionally or historically there was some reservations about sort of using Guava wholesale because it was developed in a world that was sort of pre-mobile.
Right.
Right. So its take on object creation, I don't know about the reflection part of it, but certainly object creation was not necessarily in line with what we tried to do for sort of inner loop Android.
Sure.
Programming. I don't know if that has changed, if there's been an effort on that.
Right. The second part of this story is we have now just come around to Java 8, and the work of the team sort of from this point forward is largely focused on looking at Guava specifically for Android and making sure that we are doing the best things for them. I mean, a good example of the thing that you talked about was, I believe it was Char Matcher. Char Matcher had, you know, 5,700 different char matchers, things for white space and ASCII and, you know, God knows whatever else. And in traditional server-side development, you just said, okay, well, we're going to make a whole bunch of fields and we're going to initialize them. And I want to say that if you had an Android application that triggered class loading of charMatcher, you were in order seconds waiting for this class to load with all the, you know, initialization of static fields.
Okay.
So, you know, we got the feedback from Android developers. This thing is unusable. They had to do a whole lot of work to make sure that they never accidentally touched this class if they were using Guava. And then, you know, all you do is you hide it behind a whole bunch of static methods that lazy initialize those exact same fields. And by doing that, now all of a sudden class loading is instantaneous and you pay cost for the things that you use, not, right, you know, everything in the class. The team is focused on doing that type of work and literally going through class by class, utility by utility, examining how appropriate those things are or are not for Android, what modifications need to be made to make the same utilities suitable, you know, in that Android mindset, and then, you know, moving them into the, you know, sort of blessed list of, you know, Guava for Android.
Okay.
So it must have been quite a fun thing for the team to switch everything over to Java 8, and then you start the Android work and realize, now we're going to have to require N or above if we're using all these, you know, streams and things like that, right? So,
well, this is an ongoing problem. We have a very good team that supports, you know, the sort of the sister team to our team is the team that supports the compiler and the platform. But sort of not even sort of much hotspot the platform, but, you know, Java C and sort of the whole build tool chain.
Yep.
We continue to have discussions with them about how to support this exact problem. The various versions of the Bootstrap class path, the various versions of, you know, the compiler, the various versions of tools like RetroLambda that you can put on top to get, you know, some of that same functionality, and figuring out the best way forward under all of those permutations is a lot of work, and that's probably part of the reason that it's been a long time coming. I'm sure everybody listening to this is possibly encouraged by the fact that it's happening, but possibly annoyed that it hasn't happened yet. And that is absolutely understandable. But it's a tough problem to support that many diverse environments simultaneously. But at least I know that, you know, I have strong faith in the people working on that. This is not me. I'm still going to be on Dagger. But the guys that are working on that, you know, those problems are very dedicated and, you know, exploring every option. I think we will at least have a good story and some good solutions coming soon.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you're working in a compiler, you have a lot of luxury in what you can do. I mean, I think it's tricky if you're just a pure Guava library author. You know, like if you decide to use lambdas everywhere, and everywhere you're just going to create new lambdas and call these past lambdas around, that's not going to perform well on Android, where they will be turned, at least by Jack, into individual inner classes.
Right.
But if you also control the compiler. So
also
if you
by
get
RetroLambda.
What's that?
Also by RetroLambda, isn't it doing the same thing? Actually creating a anonymous inner class on the fly to handle it.
Yes. But, you know, but yes, I think the second you start doing code generation, you can do clever things. I know the Kotlin compiler does something for something streams-like where they will inline, you know, so I think their whole runtime library is doing something clever where they can reuse single instances, you know, if you don't have variables being passed into your Lambda. So I think if you're a compiler, you can do a lot of clever stuff, but it requires, you know, I think global program analysis to do it right.
Well, and that's actually sort of a big part of the solution, I think, in the same way that Dagger sort of keeps an eye on what happens once you have that ProGuard step of full program analysis. Do all the costs that you're sort of paying superficially, do those get erased because the code that you're generating is compatible with the optimizations downstream? And so many of the same things is we can create as many lambdas as we want if ProGuard knows how to make them disappear again.
Yes. One thing that I guess I could talk about tools-wise that's helped, you know, in the past, the problem with ProGuard is that people don't run it at development time, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're using support library plus play services, you've blown through half your budget of methods, the method count already. So, you know, at debug time, people couldn't actually build because they were running out of method handles. And we have something called Multidex, which helps with this. But the problem is that requires Lollipop. You know, there's a legacy Multidex, which you could use prior to that, but it's much harder to use and much slower. And so a change we made for Instant Run last year is that we automatically look at the device you're running on. And if we detect that you're running on 21 or above, we would automatically add Multidex for you. And so the 64K method limit didn't apply. And that made builds quite a bit faster. And I think what we've done in 2.3, if I remember correctly, we're now doing that even in non-Instant Run scenarios. So we now will use multi-decks when possible, so development builds are faster. So these tricks people have done in the past where they made a separate variant, which is like this well-known trick. Make a new variant for development time where you can set the API, the minutes that get it 21, and then it's going to use multi-decks, it's faster. You don't have to do that anymore because we do it for you. And that might help here as well, right? Where, you know, you do need to use multi-decks at development time, even if ProGuards can do something better later.
Sure. And that's, you know, I don't have a whole ton of expertise on this, but I believe that that is almost exactly the system under which Android tests at Google run sort of across the board by default. The assumption is that the development time, you're certainly not going to want obfuscation, but you're not going to want, you know, sort of a lot of the other, you know, optimizations that ProGuard gives you. It just makes things harder to develop. So we do the same thing, which is just make sure that multi-decks is running. I don't know whether or not they do the same trick about detecting, you know, whether or not to use legacy multi-decks or not. But I know that certainly that's the assumption, is that development time, you will almost certainly be in, you know, multi-decks mode. And then once you get to production.
I'm guessing most Googlers probably have a device that's at least Lollipop as well.
Yes, but I mean, this is where I get a little out of my depth because I'm not an Android application developer. I have at least run across a sufficient number of, you know, when we do changes to Dagger. And one of the reasons we still focus largely on development internally is that we do a change to Dagger that's sort of sufficiently risky, and we run that change against every single, you know, build and test target that, you know, transitively depends upon it. So it's usually millions and millions of test cases. I do know that we have occasionally run across, you know, exactly that type of thing with, you know, somebody's running tests against legacy devices and legacy.
Oh, yeah, you have to. I mean, if you support API 10, you better, you know, try it.
Right.
You're going to have a bad time.
So I was curious on something you were saying earlier where, you know, they looked at Charset. What was the class?
Charmatcher.
And said, okay, these are problematic on Android for the following reasons, so we'll have static access instead. So from an API perspective, do you actually change the API of Guava, or do you introduce a new API and then sort of whitelist for, you know, then we'll have a different release for, you know, an Android library that people would build against? Like, how does this work?
So in Google, this is all very straightforward. We change everybody's code out from under them, and we don't even ask.
And then you would release an external Guava library that is incompatible with former one.
So releasing an external version of Guava is where things get tricky. And I think this is part of what they are working out specifically for, you know, this whole Android Guava effort. I know that already right now, I'm 90% sure that if you go look at Guava today, as or at least the latest release, those constants will still be present, but they will be deprecated in favor of the methods.
Okay.
How you exactly make API incompatible changes is difficult. Guava has, for a long time, had a pretty good sort of guarantee on how we change APIs that we've held ourselves to pretty well. But I want to say that the horizon is some number of years. The precise number is like, you know, 2 or 5 or something like that.
Okay.
And we have even run afoul of, you know, open source libraries that are depending on versions of Guava that people are using actively from day to day.
Yeah.
I mean, versions as old as Guava 11 or something like that.
Yeah. I can tell you in the studio code base, it was hard for us to upgrade because we loved the close quietly method that was deleted. It was replaced by one that, you know, if you, you know, it's an input reader, so it's okay. But in many cases, it was just like, we didn't have that. We just wanted to close, like, you know, you're trying to close something after you're done with it, you don't care.
Right.
And I know that was one that we missed. So I'm guessing it's like that. You know, people don't want to touch code that they're not actively working on.
Right. And so exactly how we are going to move forward with the Android, I mean, because it will be sort of a new artifact, I think we might be able to be a little more liberal with the changes.
Yeah.
But the other end of it is, every time we make a change like this, we use a tool internally called ErrorProne, which is also released externally. And I know that work is happening right now such that, you know, the function of ErrorProne is you can say, okay, look at the AST that you get from Java C. Make, you know, do whatever static analysis you'd want to detect errors or even just sort of suboptimal patterns, and then produce a new version of that code that you could then apply. And we have a system by which we can apply that en masse, you know, millions and millions of source files all at once. I know that work has been happening and is at least also checked into Head, but I'm not sure if it's hit a release yet, that allows you to do that locally. So a lot of migrations, a lot of refactorings, you can actually run a tool on your local machine and it will produce a diff that you can then apply to your code base to upgrade from, you know, deprecated methods to non-deprecated methods. Or
yeah, it's, I guess I was asking more from the perspective of, let's say, you know, as an Android developer, you have been avoiding that library because there were, you know, steep cliffs and pitfalls due to certain classes or patterns or whatever. And, you know, in general, it didn't work for you. And so you're waiting for the day when, yeah, I'd love to use Guava more generally, then how would they know, like, what to use, what not to use? Or is there some subset that, you know, is approved for Android use or whatever? Like, I'm curious, but it sounds like the answer is, you don't actually know yet because it's sort of an ongoing process of developing.
Well, they have a very formal process of when, like, they first notify it's deprecated, so you're kind of on notice. Yeah. They wouldn't just delete it, I think. But I think a trend that we've had in many Android libraries, certainly the support library and Play Services, has been to take these massive libraries and break them up into much smaller pieces.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like it would be a nice thing for Guava to do.
Sure. And I mean, just to be clear, I'm not entirely positive that even the Android-blessed version of Guava will be the same artifact as the server-side blessed version of Guava. I mean, they might just be sort of variants with identical APIs or similar APIs or whatever.
Yeah, it seems fair. I mean, I'm sort of curious about that, but it seems a bit academic at this point.
Right. I mean, internally, I know we are going through that process actively right now of sort of figuring out what is quote-unquote good for Android and what isn't. But I think the open question and the thing that's, you know, getting a lot of examination right now is how do we turn that into Guava sort of for the open source community in a way that we can, you know, produce something that is, you know, not confusing, easy to use, and also sort of not even a surprising subset, but something where you can use some, you know, an artifact that you call Guava. And that's a tricky problem because, as Tor said, is that one thing, is that, you know, 50 small pieces, is it, you know, there's work to be done there. And I think they're hard at work at that right now.
All right.
Cool.
Any final thoughts?
No, I mean, thank you so much for having me. I know we've been, you know, sort of talking about, you know, sitting down and having this chat for a while.
Yeah, interesting. We tried to set this up at least 2 years ago, and it didn't come to pass because as good as Google is about working in remote offices and working spread all over the globe, we're horrible in the podcast about doing that. Like,
yeah.
If a person is remote, we basically say, ugh, we don't know how to do that. So
we know we're going to get so much hate mail if we try to do the audio on ourselves. We need Brian to do it for us.
Yeah.
To get the good results.
Thanks for making a special trip to the studio.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I invite, you know, anybody to come sort of, you know, chime in on the GitHub issue tracker or on the Android study group Slack channel. If you're on there on the Dagger mailing list, we are enthusiastic about our open source feedback and try to, you know, take as, you know, quick and, you know, immediate and supportive action as we can. And Stack Overflow is another place that our team likes to lurk. So reach out, come contribute.
We ended on a call to action. It's pretty
excellent.
Good. All right.
That's
thank you.
First. Thanks.
Thank you.